President Keelty, there was certainly no chance he possessed that particular skeleton in his closet. When Jack Jr. arrived at his parents' house in the early afternoon, he drove through the security cordon, and a few members of the press took a picture of the yellow Hummer with Jack behind the wheel, but his windows were tinted, and he wore aviator sunglasses. When he came in through the kitchen, he saw his dad standing there, alone in his shirt sleeves. The two men embraced, and then Senior took a step back.
"What's with the shades?"
Jack Jr. took off his sunglasses, revealing bruising around his right eye. It was faint, but still gray, and it was plain that it had been much worse. In addition to the bruised skin, blood vessels in his eye had broken, and much of the eye was bright red. Ryan Sr. looked at his son's face for a moment, and then said,
"Quick, before your mom comes downstairs, into the study."
A minute later, the two men stood in the study with the door closed. Sr. kept his voice down.
"Jesus, Jack, what the hell happened to you?"
"I'd rather not say."
"I don't give a damn. What do all the parts of your body I can't see look like?"
Jack smiled. Sometimes his dad said things that showed him that the old man understood. "Not too bad. It's getting better."
"This happened in the field?"
"Yeah, I need to just leave it at that. Not for me, for you. You're about to be the president after all." Jack Ryan Sr. sighed slowly, leaned forward, and looked into his son's eyeball.
"Your mother is going to throw a..."
"I'll keep my shades on." Sr. looked at Jr.
"Son, I couldn't have pulled that trick over on Mom 30 years ago. It sure as hell won't work now."
"What should I do?" Sr. thought it over.
"You'll show her. She's an ophthalmic surgeon, for crying out loud. I want her to check you out. Tell her you don't want to talk about it. She won't like it, not one bit, but you are not lying to your mother. We can keep details from her, but we aren't lying."
"Okay," the son said.
"It's a slippery slope, but we just have to do what's right."
"Yeah." Dr. Kathy Ryan came into the study a minute later, and within seconds, she had led her son by the arm into the bathroom. Here, Kathy had Junior sit at the vanity while she held his eye open and checked it carefully with a penlight. "What happened?" Her voice was clipped and professional. The eye was his mom's area of expertise, and she would, or at least Jack hoped she would, view an injury here more professionally and dispassionately than she would had he heard something else.
"I got hit with something."
Dr. Ryan did not stop examining her patient to say, "No shit, Sherlock, what did you get hit with?" Her husband was correct. Kathy did not like her questions about the origins of the injury being deflected. Jack Jr. responded guardedly.
"I guess you could say I bumped heads with a guy."
"Any vision issues, headaches?"
"At first, yes. Bled a little from that cut on the nose, but not anymore."
"Well, he got you right in your orbit. This is a nasty subcutaneous hematoma. How long ago?"
5 days, give or take."
Kathy let go of his eye and stepped back. "You should have come right over. The trauma necessary to cause this amount of hemorrhaging on the eye and the tissue around it could have easily detached your retina." Jack wanted to say something clever, but he caught a look from his dad. Now was not the time to be cute.
"Okay, if it happens again, I will..."
"Why would it happen again?" Junior shrugged.
"It won't. Thanks for checking it out."
He started to get up from the chair. "Sit back down. I can't do anything for the subcutaneous hematoma, but I can mask that bruising on your nose and orbit."
"How?"
"I'm going to get some makeup to cover that up." Junior groaned. "It's not that bad, Mom." "It's bad enough. You are going to have your picture taken tonight, like it or not, and I am sure you don't want that image of you going out to the world." Senior agreed.
"Son, half the newspapers will go to press with a headline about how I smacked you when I learned you voted for Keelty."
Jack Jr. laughed at the thought. He knew there was no point arguing.
"Okay. Dad wears makeup every time he goes on TV. I guess it won't kill me."
The election returns began coming in during the early evening. The family and some of the key staff sat in the living room of a suite at the Marriott waterfront, although Ryan Sr. spent much of the evening standing in the kitchen, talking to his kids or his senior staff, preferring to hear reports shouted in from the living room to actually watching all the play-by-play and pontificating himself. By 9 p.m., a tight race turned for the GOP when Ohio and Michigan both went his way. Florida took until nearly 10, but by the close of polling stations on the West Coast, the matter was decided. John Patrick Ryan Sr. won with 52% of the vote, tighter than the margin he'd carried into the last month of the campaign, and most news organizations claim this had to do with two things: the Keelty administration's capture of the emir, and Jack Ryan's murky association with a man wanted for multiple murders. It said little for Keelty that Ryan had managed to overcome both of these events to defeat him. Jack Ryan stood on a stage at the Marriott waterfront with his wife and children. Balloons fell, music played. When he spoke to the adoring crowd, he thanked his family first and foremost, and the American people for giving him the opportunity to represent them for a second four-year term. His speech was upbeat, heartfelt, and even funny in places. But soon enough he came around to the two central issues of the election's home stretch. He called on President Keelty to halt his administration's pursuit of federal charges against Saif Yassin. Ryan said it would be a waste of resources, as he would order the emir into military custody as soon as he took office. He then asked President Keelty to reveal details of the sealed indictment to his transition team. He did not use the phrase, put up or shut up, but that was the implication. The president-elect reiterated his support for Clark and the men and women in the military and intelligence communities. As soon as they left the stage, Jack Jr. called Melanie. He'd seen her once since his return from Dubai. He told her he'd been on a business trip to Switzerland, where he'd banged his eye and the bridge of his nose against a tree branch when he and his co-workers tried their hand at snowboarding. He missed her tonight and wished she could be with him right now, here amid all the excitement and celebration. But they both knew that if she showed up on the arm of the son of the former and next president of the United States, it would invite a lot of scrutiny. Melanie had not even met Jack Jr.'s parents yet, and this hardly seemed like the venue for that. But Jack found a sofa in one of the suites the Ryan campaign had reserved for the evening, and he sat and chatted with Melanie until the rest of the family was ready to head back home. 59. The offices of Cosmos Space Flight Corporation in Moscow are on Sergei Makiev Street in Krasnaya Preznya, in a modern steel and glass structure that overlooks the 18th century Vagankovo Cemetery. Here, Georgi Safronov worked long hours, diligently managing his personnel, his corporation's logistical resources, and his own intellectual faculties to prepare for the launch of three Dnieper-1 rockets the following month. Alexander Verbov, KSFC's director of launch operations, was an affable, heavyset man. He was a few years older than Georgi, loyal and hardworking. The two men had been friends since the 80s. Normally, Verbov dealt with the day-to-day preparations of upcoming space launches without any help from the president of his company in the minutiae of this complicated endeavor. But Georgi had all but seconded Verbov for the much-publicized upcoming triple launch. Alexander understood that the triple launch was dear to his president's heart, and he also knew that Safronov was as technically adept as anyone in the company. Georgi had held the director of launch ops job himself once before, when Verbov was a senior engineer. If Georgi wanted to push the launch button himself on the three rockets, hell, if he wanted to work on the pad in the snow to mate the space head modules to the launch vehicles in their silos, well, as far as Alex Verbov was concerned, that was his right. But Alex was growing suspicious about one aspect of his boss's focus. The two men met daily in Georgi's office. Here they had worked together on nearly every facet of the launch since Safronov returned from his vacation. Verbov had commented repeatedly on his boss's lean physique after 3.5 weeks at a dude ranch somewhere in the western United States. Georgi looked fitter, even if his arms and hands were covered with old cuts and bruises. Cattle roping, Georgi had confided in Alexander, was incredibly tough work. Verbov had asked to see a picture of his boss in a Stetson and chaps, but Georgi had demurred. This day, like every other, they sat at Georgie's desk and sipped tea. Both men had high-end laptops open, and they worked both together and independently as they dealt with one aspect or another of the upcoming launches. Alex said, "Georgi Mikhailovich, I have the last of the confirmations that the tracking stations will be online on the required dates. Two southern launches, one northern launch." Georgi did not look up from his laptop. "Very good. We also received the updated spacecraft transit electrical link schematic, so we can troubleshoot any problems with the interface of the American satellite." "Okay." Alex cocked his head to the side. He hesitated for more than a half a minute before he said, "I need to ask you a question."
"What is it?"
"The truth is, Georgi, well, I am beginning to have some suspicions."
Georgi Safronov's eyes left his laptop and locked on the heavy man across the desk.
"Suspicions?"
Alex Verbov shuffled in his chair.
"It's just that you don't seem as interested in the actual spacecraft and the orbit of the SC as you do the launch itself. Am I correct in this?"
Safronov closed his computer and leaned forward.
"Why do you say that?"
"It just seems this way. Is there something bothering you about the launch vehicles for these flights?
No, Alex Petrovich. Of course not. What are you getting at?
Honestly, my friend, I am somewhat suspicious that you are less than pleased with my recent work, specifically regarding the LVs.
Georgie relaxed slightly.
I am very happy with your work. You are the finest launch director in the business. I am lucky to have you working on the Dnieper system and not the Protons or Soyuz craft.
Thank you.
But why are you so disinterested in the spaceflight?
Safronov smiled.
I confess that I know I could leave this all in your hands. I just prefer working on the launch. The technology for this has not changed so much in the past 15 years. The satellites and communications and tracking systems have been updated since my time in your job. I have not been keeping up with as much of my technical reading as I should. I am afraid I would not do as good a job as you, and my laziness might show in poor results.
Alex breathed a dramatic sigh and followed it with a belly laugh.
I have been so worried, Georgie. Of course you could handle the newer technology. Probably better than me. If you like, I could take you through some of the new steps to...
Alex watched Safronov open his laptop again. In seconds, he was back at work. While typing furiously, he said,
I will leave that part to you, while I do what I do best. Perhaps after the triple launch, I will have time for tutoring.
Verbov nodded, happy that his suspicions had proved totally unfounded. In seconds, he himself was back to work, and he did not think of the matter again. 60. Judith Cochran watched Saif Yassin get up from his concrete bed and make his way toward the plexiglass wall. A small writing table and a chair had been placed on his side of the glass, and here his phone sat, along with his notepad and pens. On the table next to his concrete bed, a tall stack of American law books and other papers were arranged so that he could help the PCI prepare his defense. The Justice Department had been loosening the strict rules it had set up for the Emir's defense. It seemed like every day Judy got an email or a call from someone at DOJ allowing her or her client access to more information, to more contact with the outside world, to more resources, in order for the PCI to put on a respectable defense. As soon as the path was cleared for Yassin to move to a federal cell in Virginia, then Judy would petition the court for even more access to classified material she and Saif would need to prove that he had been captured illegally and should therefore be allowed to go free. Paul Laska had confided in Judy weeks ago that he'd learned from the CIA that the men who took the Emir off the streets of Riyadh were ex-CIA men, working in no official capacity with the U.S. government. This complicated things for both sides of the federal case, but Judy was doing her best to leverage this information to her advantage. Laska had said that Ryan himself had some association with the criminals who kidnapped her client, so Judy was planning on threatening the new administration, promising to bring this relationship into the light to embarrass the President of the United States. She felt she had Ryan dead to rights, and this would make him want to sweep the Emir back under the rug by fulfilling his campaign promise to turn the man back over to a military tribunal. But she had a plan to stop that.
Good morning, Judy. You look wonderful today, Yassin said as he sat.
His smile was attractive, but Judith saw a hint of melancholy in it.
Thank you.
Before we start, I know you might be feeling down today.
Because Jack Ryan will be the next president?
Yes. I admit it is distressing news. How can your country allow this criminal back into power?
Judith Cochran shook her head. I have no idea. I do not have a single friend or co-worker who voted for him, I can promise you that.
And yet still he wins.
Judy shrugged. Large portions of my country, I am sad to say, are in the hands of racists, warmongers, and ignorant fools.
Yes, this must be true, as there seems to be no justice for an innocent man in America, said the Emir with a hint of sadness.
Do not say that. We will find justice for you. I came today to tell you that Ryan's victory is actually a good thing for your case. The Emir cocked his head.
How so?
Because Ryan's friend, John Clark, was one of the men who kidnapped you. Right now, the man is a fugitive from justice, but once Kilty's people capture him, he will be offered immunity to tell everything he knows about who he was working for when you were captured. Jack Ryan will be implicated.
How do you know this?
Because it is possible Ryan was directly involved. And even if he was not directly involved or aware of your kidnapping, we will use back channels to threaten him. To tell him that, if you are sent to military custody, we will have no other course of action but to try your case in the media, And we will use the fact Ryan gave a secret pardon as evidence Ryan himself wanted John Clark to be free to kill and kidnap innocents. Ryan might win in the court of law, but in the court of public opinion, with the vast majority of the world media on our side, it will be as if President Jack Ryan himself shot you and kidnapped you. He and his administration will have no choice but to acquiesce to our demands.
And what are our demands?
Minimum security. A reasonable sentence. Something that has you behind bars for the length of his administration, but no longer.
The emir smiled. For someone so pleasant and attractive, you are certainly a very shrewd individual.
Judy Cochran blushed. I am just getting started, Saif. Mark my words. You will win your case or we will destroy President Ryan in the process. Now the emir's grin showed no evidence of his earlier melancholy.
Is it too much to hope that both of these things happen?
Judy herself grinned.
No, not too much to hope at all.
It had been 10 days since Clark found Manfred Krohm in Cologne. The wanted American had spent the majority of that time in Warsaw, Poland. Clark had no operational reason to go to Warsaw, but his visit became operationally prudent when it became clear his body would need some recovery time after the evening fleeing the men chasing him in Germany. His right ankle had become swollen and purple. The cut on his hand needed time to heal, and every joint in his body ached. His muscles were exhausted. His low back went from a dull ache the morning after the activity to complete spasms on the morning of day 2. Warsaw was not just a town on his way from Germany to Estonia. It was a much-needed pit stop. Clark used a phony ID to rent a 1-star ensuite room at a no-name hotel in the city center. He filled the porcelain bathtub with Epsom salts and water nearly hot enough to boil a lobster, and he lowered every bit of his body in it, save for 2 extremities. His right foot, which was wrapped tight with a bag of ice and compression bandages, and his right hand, which held his Sig Sauer P220 45 caliber pistol. The hot bath and over-the-counter anti-inflammatories slowly helped him tackle his spasmed muscles. In addition to his bumps and bruises, Clark also found himself sick with an incredible sinus infection. Running through the icy rain had seen to that. Again, he used over-the-counter meds to fight this, along with a steady supply of tissues. Hot baths, downing pills, blowing his nose. Clark repeated this process over and over for almost a week before he felt not like a young man, but at least like a new man. Now he was in Tallinn, Estonia, walking past the Viru Gate, the entrance to the cobblestoned old town. He'd grown a decent beard in the past 2 weeks, and he changed his dress from the look of a late middle-aged businessman to the look of a rugged, world-weary fisherman. He wore a black watch cap low over his head, a black sweater under a blue waxed cotton raincoat, and leather boots that kept the mobility in his still-sore right ankle to a minimum. It was a Thursday evening, and the November air was frigid, so there were few pedestrians on the street. As he headed up the narrow medieval St. Catherine's Passage, Clark walked alone, feeling also the self-imposed isolation of the past few weeks. When he was younger, much younger, Clark moved in the black as a singleton asset for weeks at a time without noticing a shred of loneliness. He was not inhuman, but he was able to compartmentalize his life so that when he was operational, his mind remained on the operation. But now he thought of family and friends and colleagues. Not so much as to turn around and head back to them, but certainly more than he would have liked. It was weird, Clark thought to himself as he headed closer to his target. More than Sandy, more than Patsy. The one person he wanted to talk to right now was Ding. It was crazy that his diminutive son-in-law was at the forefront of his thoughts, and he would have laughed at the realization of it if everything going on around him weren't so damn serious at the moment. But after a moment of introspection, it made sense. Sandy had been there with him, through thick and thin, but not like Chavez. Domingo and John had been in tight spots together more often than either man would be able to count. But as much as he would have liked to, he did not entertain the thought of checking in with a quick phone call. He had walked by enough public phones, yes, they were still around here and there, that it would have been damn easy to make a quick call. But no, not yet. Not until it was absolutely necessary. No, he was operating in the black, not in the gray. He could not reach out to those who would be most imperiled by contact from him. He did not doubt for 1 second that Ding would be taking care of his wife, his daughter, and his grandkids, beyond the reach of photographers and reporters and long dormant assassins, and any other asshole who would make trouble for the family of the ex-CIA operative. Even though Ding wasn't here, standing shoulder to shoulder with him, John Clark knew Chavez still had his back, and that would have to do for now. Ardo Ruhl was the Estonian mobster who had sent the heavies to interview Manfred Krohm. The Russians had a note in a file from 1981 that the KGB had heard rumblings that a CIA heavy named Clark had come to Berlin the day Stasi agent Lucas Schumann was shot dead in a ghost station under East Berlin. The KGB interviewed Schumann's partner, Krohm, and Krohm had admitted nothing. But the loose end was still there in the Russians' file on John Clark 30 years later. So Valentin Kovalenko contacted Ardo Ruhl. The Estonian gangster had worked in his nation's intelligence service in his 20s, and now that he was out of government and operating on his own, he did odd jobs for the SVR here and there. Kovalenko asked Ruhl to send men to find this Krohm character, if he was still alive, and get to the bottom of the story. Ruhl's people found Krohm in Cologne. Ruhl and his men had the old German lockpicker come to a meet, and soon Krohm was telling the story that he had never told a soul, even identifying John Clark from a photo. It wasn't a big deal for Ruhl. The Estonian passed the intel on to Valentin Kovalenko, then went home to Tallinn after a long weekend in Germany with his girlfriend, and now he sat in his regular seat in his regular nightclub, watching the lights flash and too few Western tourists bounce up and down on the dance floor. Ruhl owned Club Hypnotech, a stylish lounge and techno dance room on Vanaturg in Tallinn's old town. He came in most nights around 11, and rarely strayed far from his throne, a corner wraparound sofa flanked by two armed bodyguards, unless it was to head up to his office alone to count receipts or surf the internet. Around midnight, he felt nature's call, and he took a circular staircase up to his second floor lair, waved his bodyguard back downstairs, and stepped into the tiny private bathroom attached to his office. He pissed, flushed, zipped, turned around, and found himself facing the barrel of a handgun.
"What the fuck?" he said it in Estonian. "Do you recognize me?"
These words were English. Ruhl just stared at the silencer.
"I asked you a question." "Lower gun, please, so I can see you," Ruhl said with a quake in his voice.
John Clark lowered the pistol to the man's heart.
"How about now?"
"Yes. You are American John Clark that everyone in your country looks for."
"I am surprised you did not expect me."
Clark glanced quickly back to the door to the circular stairs.
"You didn't expect me, did you?"
Ruhl shrugged.
"Why would I expect you?" "It's all over the news I was in Cologne. That didn't tip you off that I was looking for Krohm?"
"Krohm is dead."
This Clark did not know.
"You killed him?"
Ruhl shook his head in a way that made Clark believe him.
"They told me he'd die before you spoke to him."
"Who told you that?"
"People who scare me more than you, American."
"Then you do not know me."
Clark thumbed the hammer back on his .45. Ruhl's eyebrows rose, but he asked,
"Are we standing in bathroom much longer?"
Clark backed up, letting the man into his office, but Clark's gun remained trained on Ruhl's chest. Ruhl kept his hands up slightly, though he ran them through his spiky blonde hair as he looked toward the window to the fire escape.
"You came in through my window? It's two stories up. You'll need to find a rocking chair, old man. You behave like a child."
"If they told you I got nothing from Krohm, they probably did that because they're using you as bait. My guess is they have been watching you, waiting for me to show up."
Ruhl had not thought of this. John saw a sense of hope in the man's eyes, as if he expected someone to come to his rescue.
"And if they killed Krohm, they won't have any problem killing you."
Now John saw this realization register in the Estonian mobster's eyes. Still, he did not break easily.
"So, who sent you to Krohm?"
"Kepi omaima, old man," Ruhl said.
"That sounded like some sort of a curse.
Was that a curse?"
"It means, fuck your mother."
"Very nice." Clark raised his weapon back to the Estonian's forehead.
"If you shoot me, you have no chance. I have 10 armed men in the building. One bang from your gun and they come kill you. If you are right about more men coming, then you should think about your own."
He stopped talking and watched Clark holster the pistol. The older American stepped forward, took Ardo Ruhl by his arm, spun him around, and shoved him hard against the wall.
"I'm going to do something that will hurt. You will want to scream bloody murder, but I promise you, if you make a sound, I will do it to your other arm."
"What? No!"
Clark bent Ruhl's left arm back violently, then drove his elbow into the back of the Estonian's hyperextended elbow. Ardo Rule started a shriek, but Clark took him by his hair and slammed his face into the wall. Close in his ear, John said, "Another pound of pressure and your joint snaps. You can still save it if you don't scream."
I tell you who sent me for Manfred Krom,"
Rule said with a gasp, and Clark let up the pressure.
"A Russian fuck, Kovalenko is name. He is FSB or SVR, I do not know which. He sent me to see what Krom knows about you in Berlin."
"Why?"
Ardo's knees went slack and he slid down the side of the wall. Clark helped him to the floor. There the man sat, his face pale, his eyes wide with pain as he held his elbow.
"Why, Rule?"
"He did not say me why."
"How do I find him?"
"How do I know? His name Kovalenko, he's a Russian agent, he pay me money, this is all I know."
From downstairs at Club Hypnotech, the crack of a gunshot, then screams from women and men. Clark stood quickly and headed toward the window.
"Where are you going?"
Clark raised the window pane and looked outside, then turned back to the Estonian gangster.
"Before they kill you, remember to tell them I am coming after Kovalenko."
Ardo Rule pulled himself up to his feet with his one good arm in the corner of his desk.
"Don't leave, American. We fight them together."
Clark climbed out onto the fire escape.
"Those guys downstairs are your concern. I've got my own problems."
And with that, he disappeared into the cold darkness. Both men, American and Estonian, were roughly the same age. They were within an inch of the same height. Not more than 10 pounds separated them in their weight. They both wore their salt-and-pepper hair short. Both men had lean faces lined with age and hardened by life. There, the similarities ended. The Estonian was a drunk, a bum. Prone on the cold concrete with his head propped against the wall and a see-through plastic crate holding his life's possessions. Clark was the same build, the same age, but not the same man. He'd been standing here in the dark under the train tracks, watching the bum. He regarded the man a moment more with only a brief hint of sadness. He did not waste much energy feeling sorry for the guy, but that was not because John Clark was cold-hearted. No, it was because John Clark was on the job. He had no time for sentimentality. He walked over, knelt down, and said in Russian,
€50 for your clothes.
He was offering the destitute man $70 in local currency. The Estonian blinked over jaundiced and bloodshot eyes.
Babandust?
Excuse me?
Okay, friend, you drive a hard bargain.
Clark said it again.
You take my clothes, I give you €100.
If the homeless drunk was confused for a moment, soon it became clear. It also became clear that this was no offer. It was a demand. 5 minutes later, Clark strolled into the main rail station in Old Town Tallinn, staggering like a bum from shadow to shadow, looking for the next train to Moscow. 61. Jack Ryan Jr. spent the morning in his cubicle at Henley Associates, reading through reports generated by Melanie Kraft at the National Counterterrorism Center. Melanie's analysis dealt with the recent spate of attacks in India, and speculated that all the disparate cells involved had been run by the same operational commander. Ryan did feel some shame that he was, figuratively speaking, looking at the work over the shoulder of the girl he was dating. But this shame was offset by the knowledge that he had a crucial job to do. Rian's escalation of violence, both in North Waziristan and in Dubai, indicated to everyone at the campus that he was a dangerous and desperate man. Now, looking at Melanie's analysis that indicated similarities in the recent terrorist carnage across India, Ryan could imagine that PDF Brigadier General Riaz Rian, the Director of Foreign Espionage in the ISI, could well be this character Melanie referred to as Forrest Gump in an email to Mary Pat Foley. Jack so wished he could take her to lunch right now and fill in the blanks missing in her analysis, and pull from the raw intel that she possessed what might answer some of the questions he and the campus had about their principal targets. But telling Melanie about his work at the campus was verboten. His phone rang, and he reached for it without taking his eyes from the screen.
Ryan.
Hey, kid. Need a favor.
It was Clark.
John, holy shit, are you okay?
I'm holding together, but just. I could use your quick help.
You got it.
I need you to look into a Russian spook named Kovalenko.
Russian? Okay. Is he FSB, SVR, or military intelligence?
Clark said,
unknown. I remember a Kovalenko in the KGB back in the 80s, but that guy would be long out of the game by now. This Kovalenko could be a relative, or the name could just be a coincidence.
All right. What do you need to know about him?
Ryan was scribbling furiously as he talked.
I need to know where he is. I mean, physically, where he is.
Got it. Ryan also thought, but did not say, that if Clark wanted to find this Kovalenko, it was probably because Clark wanted to put his hands around the man's throat.
This Russian dude is a dead man.
John added,
and anything else you can get me on the guy. I'm flying blind at this point, so anything at all.
I'll assemble a team to go through CIA data, as well as open source, and we'll pull out every last thing we can on him. Is he behind this smear on you?
He's got something to do with it. Whether or not he's the nucleus of it remains to be seen.
You going to call me back?
3 hours?
Sounds good. Sit tight. A minute and a half after Clark's call, Ryan had a conference call going with a dozen employees around Henley Associates, including Jerry Henley, Rick Bell, Sam Granger, and others. Bell organized a team to dig into this Russian spook, and everyone immediately went to work. It did not take long for them to realize that Clark was right about the family connection. The Kovalenko he was looking for was the son of the Kovalenko Clark remembered from the KGB. Oleg, the father, was retired, though still alive, and Valentin, the son, was now the SVR assistant resident in London. At only 35 years old, assistant resident in London was a pretty high-level job, all agreed. But no one could figure out how he could possibly be connected to any operation that the Russians could be running against John Clark. Next, the analysts began searching through CIA traffic, looking for information on Valentin Kovalenko. These analysts did not normally spend their days tracking Russian diplomats, and they found it rather refreshing. Kovalenko was not holed up in a Waziristan cave like many of the campus's targets. The CIA had information, the vast majority obtained through the United Kingdom Security Service, also known as MI5, about his London apartment, where he shopped, even where his daughter went to school. It soon became obvious to the analysts that MI5 did not follow Kovalenko on a day-to-day basis. They did show that he had traveled from Heathrow to Domodedovo Airport in Moscow for 2 weeks in October. But since then, he had been back in London. Ryan began to wonder about Valentin's father, Oleg Kovalenko. Clark had said that he knew of the man, though it didn't sound like John harbored any suspicions that the old man himself might be involved in his current predicament. Still, Jack saw a lot of brilliant analysts all digging into Valentin. He decided there was no sense in duplicating their efforts, so instead he figured, what the hell, he'd work the Oleg angle. For the next half hour, he read from the archives of the CIA about the KGB spy, specifically his exploits in Czechoslovakia, in East Germany, in Beirut, and in Denmark. Jack Jr. had been in the game for only a few years, but to him, the man did not seem to have a particularly remarkable career, at least as compared with some other personal histories of Russian spies that he had read. After digging through the man's past, Jack put his name into a Homeland Security database that would tell of any international travel he might have made to Western countries. A single trip popped up. The elder Kovalenko had flown on Virgin Atlantic to London in early October.
To see his son, perhaps? Jack wondered.
If it was a family reunion, it was a damn short one. Just 30 hours in country. The short trip was curious to Jack. He strummed his fingers on the desk for a moment, and then called Gavin Byrie. Hey, it's Jack. If I give you the name of a foreign national, and I give you the dates he was in the UK, could you find his credit cards and get me a list of transactions he made while he was there, so I can use that to try and track his movements? Jack heard Byrie whistle on the other end of the line.
Shit,
Byrie said.
Maybe.
How long will it take?
Couple of days at least.
Ryan sighed. Never mind. Byrie started to laugh. Ryan thought, what a fucking weirdo. But only until Gavin said,
just messing with you, Jack. I can have that for you inside of 10 minutes. Email me the guy's name and anything else you have on him, and I'll jump on it.
Okay. 10 minutes later, Ryan's phone rang. He answered with, what did you find out? Gavin Byrie mercifully recognized the urgency in Ryan's voice.
Here's the deal. He was in London, no question. But he didn't pay for a hotel or a car or anything like that. Just a few gifts and an incidental or two.
Ryan sighed in frustration. So it sounds like someone else paid for his trip.
He bought his own plane ticket. Put it on a card, but once he was in London, he was on someone else's dime.
Okay. Guess that won't do me any good.
What were you hoping to find?
I don't know. Just fishing. I hoped this trip had something to do with the Clark situation. I guess I thought if I could track him for the 30 hours he was in town, I could get an idea.
I know where he stayed.
You do?
He bought a box of cigars in the gift shop of the Mandarin Oriental at 7:56 in the evening. Then he bought a box of Cadbury chocolates in the gift shop there at 8:22 the next morning. Unless he was just really in love with that gift shop, it sounds like he bedded down there for the night.
Jack thought this over. Can you get a look at all the rooms that night?
Yeah, I checked. No Valentin Kovalenko.
Oleg Kovalenko?
Nope.
So someone else, not his son, paid his way. Can we get a list of every credit card that held a room for that night?
Sure, I can pull that out. Call you back in 5?
Ryan said. I'll be at your desk in 3.
Ryan showed up at Byrie's desk with his own laptop, which he opened as he plopped into a chair next to the computer guru. Byrie handed Ryan a printout, so Ryan and Gavin both could scan through the list of names of those registered at the hotel. Ryan didn't know what he was looking for exactly, which made delegating half of the search to Gavin practically impossible. Other than the name Kovalenko, which Byrie had already said was not here, or the highly unlikely discovery of the name Edward Kielty, he didn't really know what would pique his interest. He wished like hell he could be sitting with Melanie right now. She would find a name, a pattern, something. And then, from out of the blue, Jack got an idea in his head.
Vodka,
he shouted. Gavin smiled.
Dude, it's 10:15 in the morning unless you've got some Bloody Mary mix.
Ryan wasn't listening. Russian diplomats who visit the UN in New York are always getting in trouble for drinking all the vodka in their minibars.
Says who?
I don't know, I've heard it before. Might be an urban legend, but look at this guy. He pulled up a photo of Oleg Kovalenko on his laptop.
You can't tell me he wasn't tipping back the stoli. He's got that big red nose, but what does that have to do with his trip to London?
Check for a room with minibar charges or a bar tab charged to the room. Byrie ran another report on his computer, and as he was doing so, he said,
or room service, specifically a liquor tab.
Exactly, agreed Ryan. Gavin began going through the itemized credit card charges of the subset of rooms that had ordered room service or charged bar items to their room. He found a few possibles, then a few more. Finally, he settled on one charge in particular.
Okay, here we go. Here is a room paid for by an American Express Centurion card under the name of Carmela Zimmern.
Okay, so?
So it looks like Ms. Zimmern, in her one evening at the Mandarin Oriental, enjoyed 2 servings of beluga caviar, 4 bottles of Finlandia vodka, and 3 porno movies.
Ryan looked at the digital receipt on Gavin's laptop. When he saw the 3 in-room entertainment charges, he was confused.
How do you know they were pornos? Look, they all ran at the same time. I guess Oleg wanted the channel flipped through the chatty parts.
Oh, Ryan said, still putting this together. He started scrolling through the names on his sheet again. Wait a second. Carmela Zimmern also booked the royal suite the same night. That's nearly 6 grand. So Kovalenko was in the other room? He was there to see her, maybe?
Sounds plausible.
Shit, thought Jack. Who is this Carmela Zimmern? They Googled the name and found nothing. Well, not nothing. There were several Carmela Zimmerns. One was a 14-year-old girl in Kentucky who played lacrosse, and another was a 35-year-old mother of 4 in Vancouver who loved to crochet. They looked them over, one at a time, but there was certainly no one that looked like they'd be spending lavishly on 5-star hotels or entertaining Russian spies in the UK.
I'll find the address on her card,
Byrie said, and he began clicking his keyboard. While he did this, Jack Ryan Jr. hunched over his laptop, reading through anything he could find on Carmela Zimmern's in social media, on random websites, anywhere in open source. Within a minute of beginning his search, he said, holy shit.
What?
This one works for Paul Laska.
The Paul Laska?
Yep. Carmela Zimmern, 46 years old, lives in Newport, Rhode Island, works for the Progressive Nations Institute. Gavin finished his check of the Amex card.
That's our girl. Address in Newport.
Interesting. Laska's P&I is based in New York.
Right, but Laska himself is in Newport.
So she works directly with the old bastard.
Looks that way.
When Clark phoned back, the call came through the speakerphone in the 9th floor conference room. All the principals were there, some still poring over the information Ryan and Byrie had just dug up. John, it's Ryan. I've got everyone here with me.
Hey, guys.
Everyone in the room quickly called out to Clark one at a time. Clark hesitated before speaking.
Where's Driscoll?
Hendley took this.
He's in Pakistan. Still? He's a POW. Haqqani has him. Fuck. God damn it.
Jerry interjected.
Look, we have a viable lead on getting him out of there. There is hope.
Embling, Is he your lead?
Nigel Embling is dead, John. Killed by Riaz Rian. Henley said it softly.
What the hell is going on? Clark asked.
It's complicated, Jerry said,
putting it extremely mildly.
But we're working on that end. Let's concentrate on your situation for now. How are you?
Clark sounded tired and angry and frustrated all at the same time.
I'll be better when this gets worked out. Any word on Kovalenko?
Henley looked at Jack Jr. and nodded.
Yes.
Valentin Kovalenko, age 35, he is SVR's assistant resident in London.
And he's in Moscow?
No, he was there in October, but only for a couple of weeks.
Shit,
said Clark, and Ryan got the impression from this reaction that Clark was in Moscow. There's more, John.
Go.
Kovalenko's father, Oleg, like you said, he was KGB.
Yesterday's news, Jack, he's got to be 80.
He's nearly that, but listen for a second. This guy never goes anywhere outside of Russia. I mean, not as far back as Homeland Security's records go. But in October, he flies to London.
To see his kid?
To see Paul Laska, apparently. There was a long pause.
The Paul Laska?
Yep, said Ryan. This is preliminary, but we think it is possible that they knew each other in Czechoslovakia.
Okay, Clark said it with a confused tone. Go on.
Right after Oleg's visit to London, Valentin races over to Moscow for 2 weeks. He gets back to London, and a few days later, the indictment on you drops out of the sky.
Clark filled in what he knew.
When he was in Moscow, Valentin sent a crew of thugs out to get intel on me from sources in my file with the KGB.
Weird, said Caruso, who'd been silent until now. If he is SVR, why didn't he send his own people?
Clark answered this quickly.
He wanted to use cutouts to insulate him and his service from this.
So Valentin knows about you through Laska? Asked Ryan.
Looks like it.
Ryan was confused. And Laska knows about you? How?
Sam Granger answered this.
Paul Laska runs the Progressive Constitution Initiative, the group that is defending the Emir. Somehow the Emir fingered Clark, and Laska is orchestrating this all with Russia because he can't let on that the Emir is passing intel to him.
Henley ran his fingers through his gray hair.
The Emir may have described Clark to his lawyers. They somehow got a picture of you from CIA.
So Paul Laska and his people are using the Russians running their version of a false flag operation, said Clark.
But why would the Russians go along with this? Asked Chavez.
To hobble the Ryan presidency, or maybe even kill it outright.
We have to go after Laska, said Caruso.
Hell no, Henley said. We don't operate inside America against Americans. Even misguided sons of bitches like him.
A mild argument broke out in the room, with Caruso and Ryan on one side and the rest of the men on the other. Chavez stayed out of it for the most part.
Clark stopped the argument.
Listen, I understand and respect that. I will try to get more information on my end that we can use, and then I will report back.
Thank you, said Jerry Henley.
There is another situation.
What's that?
The crew coming after me. Not Russians, not Americans. French. One of them died in Cologne. I didn't kill him, exactly, but he's just as dead. Don't guess his buddies are going to listen to my side of it.
The men in the conference room looked at one another for a moment. They had all heard the news about the death of the Frenchman, supposedly at the hands of John Clark. But if Luc Patin was part of a team after Clark, that meant there was another force involved in all this. Finally, Rick Bell said,
"We'll try to find out who they are. Maybe we can look into the dead guy a lot closer than the international media has, try and find out who he was working for."
Clark said, "I appreciate it. It wouldn't hurt to know what I'm dealing with on that front. Okay, got to go. You guys focus on getting Sam back."
"Will do," said Chavez. "Watch yourself, John."
When Clark hung up, Dominic turned to Domingo.
"Ding, you've known Mr. C the longest. He sounded tired, didn't he?"
Chavez just nodded.
"How much longer can he go on? The guy's what, 63, 64? Shit, he's more than twice my age and I'm feeling the effects of everything I've been through the past few weeks."
Chavez just shook his head as he looked off into the distance.
"No point in speculating how long his body can hold up to the day-to-day wear and tear."
"Why not?"
"Because if you do what John does, sooner or later, you're going to go out quick. One of the bullets that have been whizzing past his head for damn near half a century is going to have his name on it. And I'm not talking about that little scratch he got in Paris."
Caruso nodded. "I guess we all have an expiration date on us, doing what we do."
"Yep. We roll the dice every time we go out."
The meeting was breaking up, but the conference room was still full when a call light on the phone console in the center of the table blinked again. Henley himself picked it up.
Yeah? Good, put him through.
Henley looked to the men standing around.
It's Al Darkur.
He punched the conference button to put the call through the speakers.
Hello, Muhammad. You are speaking to Jerry, and the others are listening in.
Good.
Tell me you have good news.
Yes, we have found your man. He is still in North Waziristan, in a walled compound in the town of Azizkel.
Chavez leaned over the desk.
What are you going to do about it?
I have planned a raid on the compound. At this point, I have not asked for approval because I do not want the information to leak out to the men holding him. But I expect the rescue attempt will launch within 3 days' time.
Chavez asked,
How did you happen to find out about this compound?
The ISI has known about the compound. It is used as a prison for kidnapped victims of Siraj Haqqani. But the ISI did not have anyone of value held there, so there was no reason to risk tipping our hand about the existence of our intelligence asset that provided the information. I persuaded someone to tell me.
Chavez nodded.
How many Gomers you think are there?
Al Darkur paused on the other end.
How many what?
Sorry. How many of Haqqani's people? How much opposition at the compound?
A longer pause.
Maybe you would prefer to not know the answer to that question.
Chavez shook his head.
I'd rather have bad news than no news, something I learned from a friend of mine.
I think your friend is very wise. I am sorry that the news is bad. We expect there will be no less than 50 Haqqani fighters billeted within 100 meters of where Sam is being held.
Ding looked at Jack and Dom. Both men just nodded to him.
Mohammed, we'd like to come over as soon as possible.
Excellent. You men proved your talents in Dubai. I could use you again.
After the phone conversation with the ISI major, the three campus operators sat back down at the table. They were joined again by Henley and Granger. It was clear that Jack, Dom, and Ding wanted to go to Pakistan, and they wanted to be involved in the raid on the compound where, according to the ISI, Sam Driscoll was being held captive by the Haqqani network. Henley did not want to send them, but as they pled their case, he realized he could not deny them the chance to rescue their friend. Jerry Henley had lost his wife and three kids in a car crash. He'd lost Brian Caruso the year before in a campus mission that he approved, and these facts were not lost on the other men in the room. Jerry wanted Sam back as much as or more than anyone else on the team. He said,
Men, right now, like it or not, Clark is on his own. We will support him here in any way we can if he checks in with us and requests more help. This opportunity to go after Sam...
Henley just shook his head.
It sounds like a shit sandwich. It sounds really dicey. But I will never be able to live with myself if I don't allow you guys the chance to go after him. It is up to the three of you.
Chavez said, We'll go to Pesh and talk to Al Darkur. I trust him. If he says the men who are leading the raid are on the up and up, well, that's about all we can ask for, isn't it?
Henley agreed to let them go, but he was under no illusions they were just going to feel the situation out. He could tell by the looks in their eyes that these three men would be heading into battle, and he wondered if he could live with himself if they did not come back. 62. General Riaz Rian sent a message to all of the organizations under his control. Not to the leadership of the organizations, but to dozens of individual cells. The active units in the field were the men Rian trusted to do their duty to his cause. And he took the time to spend the day in communication via email, Skype, and sat phone, ordering them all into action. India was the target. D-Day was now. Attacks began within hours, along the border between the countries, deep in the Indian interior. Even Indian embassies and consulates in Bangladesh and other countries were attacked. To those asking, why now, the answers varied. Many in the world press blamed President-elect Jack Ryan for his verbal attacks on the weak Pakistani government. But those in the know could tell the coordination necessary for these actions meant the plans had been in place for some time, long before Ryan promised he would back India if Pakistan did not end its support for terrorism. Most people also knew that there was no reason to ask, why now? Because although the scale of the conflict had increased in the past month, the conflict itself had been going on for decades. The operation that Riaz Rian had put into action in the past months, beginning with the attack on the Electronics City Tollway in Bangalore, had come to him in a dream many years before, in May of 1999. At that time, India and Pakistan were in the midst of a brief border skirmish that became known as the Kargil War. Pakistani forces crossed the line of control between the two nations, small battles raged, and artillery shells crashed down inside the borders of both countries. Rian was there on the border at the time, organizing militant groups in Kashmir. He had heard a rumor, later proven true, that Pakistan had begun readying some of its nuclear arsenal. The Pakistanis had possessed nuclear weapons for more than a decade by this point, although their first test of an atomic weapon had just taken place the year before. They had nearly 100 warheads and air-to-ground bombs, all kept disassembled but ready for quick assembly and deployment in case of national emergency. That night, sleeping in a mountain redoubt straddling the line of control, Rian dreamt nuclear weapons were brought to his hut by a large Saker Falcon. The Saker ordered Rian to detonate warheads on both sides of the border in order to create an all-out nuclear war between the two nations. He set off the weapons along the border. The war escalated to the cities, and out of the ashes of the radioactive fires, Rian himself emerged as Caliph, the leader of the new Caliphate of Pakistan. Since the night of the dream, he had thought of the Falcon and the Caliphate each and every day. He did not see his dream as the ruminations of a manipulative mind pulling data out of the real world and spinning it subconsciously into fantasy. No, he saw his dream as a message from Allah. Operational orders, just like he would obtain directives from his ISI handlers, and just like he would relay his orders on to the cells under his control. Now, 13 years later, he was ready to put his plan into practice. Operation Saker, he called it, in honor of the Falcon who came to him in the dream. Over time, he had seen it become necessary to change the operation somewhat. He realized India, with many, many more nuclear devices than Pakistan and better delivery capabilities, would destroy Pakistan if a true nuclear war broke out. Plus, Rian realized, India was not preventing Pakistan from becoming a true theocracy. No, Pakistan itself was the impediment, or more precisely, the Pakistani secularists. So he decided instead to use the theft of nuclear devices to topple the weak civilian leadership of his country. The citizenry would accept military rule. They had done so many times before, but not if it turned out the ISI or the PDF had stolen the nukes themselves to effect the change in leadership. So Rian devised a plan to hand off the nukes to some Islamic militant group outside Pakistan to throw off the scent that the entire operation was an inside job. Once the government fell, Rian would take control and he would purge the military of secularists, and he would unleash his force of militant groups on secularists within the citizenry. And Rian would become Caliph. Who better than he, after all? He had become, through years of following the orders of others, a one-man conduit between all the Islamic organizations fighting on behalf of the Islamists in the military. Without Rian, the ISI could not control Lashkar-e-Taiba. They would not have the support of Al-Qaeda that they enjoyed. They would not have the other 20 or so groups doing their bidding. And they certainly would not possess the money and support that they received from Rian's personal benefactors in the Gulf states. General Rian was not known in his country at large. He was very much the opposite of a household name. But his return to the PDF and his ascension to department director in the ISI had given him the status he needed to lead a coup against the secular government in charge when the time was right. He would have the support of the Islamists in the army, because Rian had the support of the 24 largest Mujahideen groups in the country. The ISI's success depended on this large, uncoordinated, but quite powerful proxy force, and the ISI-PDF leadership had created in their man Rian something of a necessary link between themselves and their crucial civilian army. Rian was no longer just the cutout. Rian had, by his work, his intelligence, and his guile, made himself a secret king, and Operation Saker was his route to his throne. 63. Domingo Chavez, Dominic Caruso, and Jack Ryan Jr. stepped out of the AS-332 Super Puma helicopter and into a freezing cold pre-dawn. Though none of the three men had a clue just where they were as far as a point on a map, they all knew from conversations over the satellite phone with Major Al-Darkur that they were being transported to an off-limits military base in Khyber Agency, run by the Pakistani Defense Forces Special Service Group. In fact, they were in Sherat, some 35 miles from Peshawar, in a compound resting at 4,500 feet. This commando camp would be the staging ground for the SSG hit into North Waziristan. The American men were led by stone-faced, hardened soldiers to a shack near a parade ground on a flat stretch of dirt surrounded by lush hills. Here they were offered hot tea and shown racks of gear, woodland camouflage uniforms in brown and black over green, and black combat boots. The men changed out of their civilian dress. Ryan had not worn a uniform since high school baseball. It felt strange and somewhat disingenuous to dress like a soldier. The Americans were not given the maroon berets worn by the rest of the SSG men in the compound, but otherwise, their dress looked identical to the others in the camp. When all three men were decked out in the same kit, another helicopter landed on the helipad. Soon, Major Aldarkour, himself dressed in identical combat fatigues, stepped into the shack. The men all shook hands. The major said, "We have all day to go over the mission. We will attack tonight." The Americans nodded as one. "Is there anything at all that you need?" Chavez answered for the group. "We're going to need some guns." The major smiled grimly. "Yes, I believe you will." At 8 a.m., the three campus operatives stood on the base's rifle range, test-firing their weapons. Dom and Jack were outfitted with the Fabrique Nationale P90 automatic rifle, a space-age-looking weapon that was excellent for close-quarters combat due to a bullpup design which shortened the length of the barrel that extended past the body of the user. This helped an operator move through doorways without telegraphing his movements in advance with a protruding barrel. The gun also fired a potent but light 5.7mm by 28mm round from a hardy 50-round magazine. Chavez opted for a Steyr AUG in 5.45mm. It had a longer barrel than the P90, which made it more accurate at distance, as well as a 3.5x power scope. The Steyr might not have been as good as the P90 for close-in operations, but Chavez was first and foremost a sniper, and he felt the weapon was a fair trade-off. Chavez worked with the two younger men on their rifles, had them practice magazine changes while standing, kneeling, and lying prone, and firing the guns on semi-auto and full-auto while stationary and on the move. They also trained with three different types of grenades they would bring in on the op. Small Belgian mini-frag grenades, M84 stun grenades that delivered an incredible flash and bang after a two-second delay, and a nine-banger stun distraction device that gave off nine less powerful explosions in rapid succession. During a break in the action to reload their mags, Major Aldarkour appeared on the far side of the large outdoor range, carrying an M4 rifle and a metal can of ammunition. Chavez had his two less experienced partners continue while he stepped over to the dark-skinned Pakistani.
"What are you doing?" Ding asked.
"I am test-firing my rifle."
"Why?"
"Because I am going with you." The major placed Oakley protective glasses over his eyes. "Mr. Sam was my responsibility, and I failed. I will accept the responsibility for getting him back."
Chavez nodded.
"I'm sorry I doubted you before."
Aldarkour shrugged.
"I do not blame you. You were frustrated about losing your friend. If the situation had been reversed, I would have felt the same outrage."
Ding put a gloved hand out, and Muhammad shook it. Aldarkour asked,
"Your men, how are they?"
"They are good, but they don't have much experience. Still, if your commandos occupy the forces at the perimeter, and the three of us move as a team through the compound, then I think we will be okay."
"Not three of you, four of us. I will go inside the compound with you."
Now Chavez's eyebrows rose.
"Major, if you were bluffing, you were shit out of luck, because I am not going to turn you down."
Mohammed flipped the safety off his rifle and fired five quick shots downrange, each bullet banging against its target, a small iron plate that gave off a satisfying clang.
"It is no bluff. I got Nigel and Sam into this. I cannot help Nigel, but perhaps I can help Sam."
"You are welcome on my team," said Chavez, immediately impressed with the Pakistani man's shooting.
"And when you have your man back," Aldarkour continued, "I hope your organization will continue its interest in General Rian. You seem to take him as a serious threat, as do I."
"We do indeed," admitted Chavez.
The afternoon in Sherat was spent in a briefing by the Zarar commandos, the unit that would head into North Waziristan with the Americans. The briefing was led primarily by a captain who explained what everyone should do and what everyone should see, up until the moment when the Americans went inside the main building, where intelligence reports had indicated the prisoners were being kept. The SSG captain used a marking board and an authoritative voice.
"The helo carrying the Americans will land directly in front of the gate, and the three Americans will depart and then breach the gate. We cannot land in the courtyard inside due to electrical wires. Our four helicopters will then go to points above the four walls of the camp and circle there, and we will provide covering fire for the entry team. This should occupy enemy forces in the building outside of the camp as well as those in the courtyard or those in windows. But it will do nothing for the entry team once they are inside the buildings themselves. We have no intelligence as to what the inside of the camp looks like,
nor do we know where the prisoners are being held. Unfortunately, the Agani network captives at our disposal have not been into the main building itself, only to the barracks on the eastern side. Caruso.